Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It's Oscar time. The ceremony is this Sunday, so we're here to share our thoughts before the big night and maybe give you an edge in your Oscar pool. I'm Linda Holmes.
And I'm Stephen Thompson. We've got a lot of opinions about the nominees, and we don't just mean the biggest ones. Foreign films, animated films, and maybe a few things that aren't nominated but should have been.
Also joining us is Glenn Weldon from NPR's Arts Desk. Hi, Glenn.
Hey, Linda.
And of course, as always, joining us for our Oscar show is our buddy Bob Mondello from All Things Considered. Hi, Bob.
Hey, good to be here.
It's always, I feel like we gather together every year. We see Bob, not nearly often enough.
Bob is our eggnog.
But this is the first year in a while that we have actually covered all of the Best Picture nominees in full episodes.
Is it true?
Yeah. Wow. Those nominees, if you're not familiar.
So go back and spend like 2.5 hours.
Exactly. You got your Call Me By Your Name, mm-hmm. your Get Out, your Lady Bird, your Dunkirk, mm-hmm. The Post, mm-hmm. The Shape of Water, mm-hmm. Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, mm-hmm. and The Darkest Hour, yeah. mm-hmm. and one that I'm forgetting.
Phantom Thread. Which is easily forgettable.
Now,
many disagree.
Those are fighting words. Those are fighting words, Bob. Although there was a very funny interview with Jennifer Lawrence this morning when she said she made it 3 minutes into that movie. And she was like, I don't need to.
And she was in Mother.
She basically said, like, I don't really need to sit around looking at a story about narcissistic sociopaths. And I was like, okay, I'm going to let that drop. Stephen, what in your ideal universe, what would win Best Picture out of these nominees?
For a while, I was a snarky bastard saying, you know, anything but Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri.
Sure.
I've now gotten a little bit, I've decided to raise my bar a little bit. I really just want it to be either Get Out or Lady Bird. And really, either of those, I don't think either of them is actually going to win, mm-hmm. but either one of those would absolutely thrill me. I would also, you know, there are several other terrific movies out of the nine, but those were my two favorite movies of the year.
So you don't think either one of those are going to win. Do you think it will be Three Billboards?
I'm a superstitious person, mm-hmm. so I sort of always pick the thing I least want to have happen.
But, and usually that works.
And very often I'm not disappointed, at least in that regard. But it does seem like The Shape of Water has picked up a lot of momentum. I do think it's going to win Best Director, in part because Three Billboards isn't nominated in that category. Oh, man. I've been going back and forth on it. I'm just going to go ahead, put my money down on Three Billboards.
Glenn, what would you pick?
Well, I mean, Get Out, Lady Bird, Call Me By Your Name, any one of those three, mm-hmm. I'm fine with. My esteem for Phantom Thread at Dunkirk has increased over the mm-hmm. of the course of the Oscar season, and my esteem for Shape of Water, Billboards, and Darkest Hour has decreased. My esteem for The Post has remained exactly the same, because mm-hmm. that's what would happen with that movie. Just exactly the same. Everything, the major categories have seemed locked in.
Yeah.
In terms of acting, especially, they win the Golden Globes. They win. There's a sameness there. But Best Picture is interesting because it's the only category that's weighted, where people pick their first choice, their second mm-hmm. choice, third choice. That's throwing things off. If we were just going by Oscar season, Shape of Water would be a lock. But I don't get the sense it is. So if we're just going by the course of the Oscar season, then Shape of Water would seem like a lock. But that's up in the air because of this weighted voting. And also because there's a whisper campaign about plagiarism that's certainly affecting the buzz of that movie. But any of those three, Call Me By Your Name, Get Out, Lady Bird, I'm happy.
Yeah, if you're not familiar with the whisper campaign that Glenn is referencing, it has to do with similarities between The Shape of Water and a play called Let Me Hear You Whisper, which I remember reading when I was in school. And you can sort of evaluate those similarities and differences for yourself.
There lots and lots of fish sex in that play.
Anyway, so Bob, what would you pick out of all of these? I think I know the answer.
I think the one that you expect me to say is Call Me By Your Name. Mm-hmm. And I did love that to a point that is just crazy. I think it's a gorgeous movie. I would actually like to see Get Out win mm-hmm. much more than I would any of the others. And I think what is actually going to happen, and I'm torn because Glenn's got a good point about this weighted thing that it could really affect. For a while there, with all the other awards, there was no question Shape of Water was the film to beat this year. Mm-hmm. In the last few weeks, actually in the last week, Three Billboards in all the odds is coming up because people are starting to do that weighted thing mm-hmm. and starting to figure out how it will play. So I think there's a real possibility that Three Billboards will win. That strikes me as a little odd, and I'd still like to see Get Out happen. And the reason I think there's a possibility of that is the success of Black Panther. And I think that this year, people may be making a weighted decision in their own heads about things. So I would hope that Get Out has a good shot there.
Do you think that the weighted system would hurt polarizing movies, that movies that are either first or ninth?
In theory,
if you're going to put it as your last choice because you're pissed off about it, yes, it could hurt them.
You know, it's funny. My pick, I think, would be Get Out, although in a very tight race with Lady Bird, which I also loved. You know, last year at this time, I had been saying and saying and saying, it's going to be Moonlight. La La Land peaked too early. It's going to be Moonlight. And at the very last minute, I lost my nerve. And going into our Oscar show, I said, no, never mind. I take it back. It is going to be La La Land. And I was almost so vindicated.
You were so almost right.
I was almost so vindicated. So this year, I'm sticking with my gut. Mm-hmm. And I think it is going to be Get Out. And I'll tell you why. I think what happened with Moonlight was, even if it wasn't your absolute, absolute favorite movie, people admired the audacity, not audacity in terms of just the storytelling, but the unusualness of it in Hollywood, right? I think even if it wasn't your favorite movie, you had to admire what it represented in Hollywood, not just in terms of representation, but just how different the storytelling was. Mm-hmm. And I think with Get Out, even people who don't necessarily think it's their favorite movie of the year can understand how interesting and thoughtful it is, and can understand that it shook people up in a certain way, and can be really excited about the emergence of Jordan Peele and Daniel Kaluuya and some of the other people who are involved in that film. Whereas I do think Three Billboards has grown more polarizing over time, actually in an analogous way to the way La La Land did, weirdly enough. When La La Land first came out, it also got really happy reviews. And then the more people kind of dug into what it was really saying and got past kind of some of the surface pleasures of it, people asked a lot more questions about it. And I think it tumbled down a lot of people's rankings for some of those reasons, not necessarily strictly speaking just politics, but just taking a deeper look at what a film is doing. I think Get Out has only increased in a lot of people's estimation as we've gotten farther away from it. And there are echoes in terms of Black Panther, but there's also just, I think the farther people have gotten away from that movie, the more they have admired it. And I think Three Billboards has in some ways gone the other way. Mm-hmm. I definitely think over the course of many years, the critical fortunes of those films will cross over.
Yeah.
And Get Out will remain very well regarded, whereas Three Billboards will become Crash, just my opinion. But I think the question is that happening fast enough for the Best Picture race to flip? Maybe not, but I'm going to say yes.
Well, remember that Get Out came out more than a year ago. So it came out in February of 2017. People have certainly had time. That movie has had time to grow in people's estimation. Bob, you mentioned that Three Billboards is kind of was lagging and is now coming on strong. I kind of feel like the opposite is true, because it felt inevitable when we were watching the Golden Globes and when we were kind of plodding through the early part of award season. That film felt like Birdman. You know, it just felt like,
oh,
man, it's going to be Birdman.
In the odds, the way the Gold Derby and the other odds-making sites have been looking at it, it was always number two or number three.
Yeah.
And now it's number one.
Yeah. And the thing is, those things, a lot of those things just come down to other people's hunches.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And, of course, precursor awards and things like that. And there's something to be said for Guild Awards and awards that, you know, I wouldn't necessarily have given Three Billboards that it's already won. But maybe, like, non-frontrunner pictures won't triumph 2 years in a row.
Right.
But this year, I'm going with my gut. Get Out.
Get Out.
Right.
That's great.
And let's say you're an Oscar voter who does feel conflicted about Three Billboards. You can still vote for McDormand and Rockwell for those performances. And that's what has happened over the course of Oscar season.
Mm-hmm.
People voting for that and then voting for Shape of Water as Best Picture. Mm-hmm. So, again, it gets cloudy once you start doing the weighted voting, what's going to happen. But that seems to be the pattern that we're building through.
I can totally imagine Get Out being everyone's third choice, right, or
better. So I do want to talk a little bit about acting categories. I think, you know, Glenn mentioned a sense that the acting categories, both lead and supporting, are, you know, feel a little bit predetermined, right? Lead actress Frances McDormand in Three Billboards, lead actor Gary Oldman in Darkest Hour.
I'm sitting here, I want to do the impression so bad.
Yep.
Supporting actress Allison Janney in I, Tonya, who's been beating out Laurie Metcalf from Lady Bird to a lot of people's chagrin.
Mm-hmm.
And supporting actor Sam Rockwell, also in Three Billboards.
Yeah.
we watched, you know, all of the acting categories. Glenn, would you take issue with those front runners?
I would love to see Metcalf pull away with this. Not because I have anything against Allison Janney, because that's the law. But I think there are some interesting performances that haven't gotten talked about a lot. I did see Mudbound with Mary J. Blige, mm-hmm. and she is nominated for Best Supporting Actress for that. And that is a really smart, good performance that is doing good work in that movie, which depicts some pretty awful things. Mm-hmm. And it is so starkly that you can feel like evil is being visited upon the earth. And so you need a backbone for that movie to work.
Yeah.
You need something quieter for that to work against, mm-hmm. for us to see the real stakes. And I think between her and Carey Mulligan, they are providing some of the quieter moments in that film, mm-hmm. and some of the better moments in that film.
What's really surprising to me about that movie, which we didn't do a full segment on, is the subtlety of the Mary J. Blige performance.
Yeah.
And when I talk about Mary J. Blige's music, mm-hmm. a word I do not use is subtle. And if you want to listen to Mighty River, which is nominated for Best Song, that's a Mary J. Blige song, it is not subtle.
Yeah.
But her performance is very contained and very, very, very impressive.
Yeah.
One of the things when people who have mostly done music or, you know, some other, or dancing or mm-hmm. some other thing, come into acting. This is not the first time she's ever acted, but when they come into, you know, a major acting spotlight in such a kind of quiet role, as you're saying, one of the things that not everybody can do is kind of cut off the out energy of mm-hmm. being the kind of performer that they are the rest of the time. You know, we talked a little bit about Harry Styles in Dunkirk, and I actually think Harry Styles is fine in Dunkirk,
sure.
but he does have a little bit of kind of sparkliness, of kind of starness, and mm-hmm. it works for that character because of who the character is. That wouldn't work here.
Right.
It's her ability to really pull that performance in is a very specific skill that I think not everybody who comes in from music or some other field necessarily possesses.
It's so funny. I have no concept of her as a musical artist. I know that is I am such a creature of movies. Well, of age and movies. Be nice. Mm-hmm. That I didn't have an image of her coming into the film, and so this was my image until I went and looked at some videos
mm-hmm.
of her.
Yeah.
And I have to say, she does it beautifully. She's clearly a performer, which I'm now aware of in ways that I wasn't before. But she does a remarkable job in that film. She's really lovely, which does not yeah. make me want to give it to anybody but Laurie Metcalf.
No, right.
I adore.
Right. What I come up against in these categories every year is you can love more than one performance.
Yeah.
And,
uh-huh.
and I, mm-hmm. even more than with films, I dislike this exercise with acting because I think Mary J. Blige is great in this. I think Laurie Metcalf is great in Lady Bird. I think what Allison Janney is asked to do in I, Tonya is probably not as complicated as what Metcalf is asked to do in Lady mm-hmm. Bird. But
right.
she does it very well, and she's very funny.
She's in, great in that movie.
She's great in that movie. So it's even more than with films, I feel like you wind up diminishing people just by liking something else and advocating
sure.
for something
and can
else.
I just mention that Leslie Manville in
yeah.
Phantom Thread, as much as I was not fond of that movie,
yeah.
oh my God, she
yeah.
controls
yeah.
every moment she's in.
Yeah. yeah, I think she's very important to that film.
And I think I was surprised by the Denzel Washington nomination for lead actor for Roman J. Israel Esquire, only because I'd never heard of Roman J. Israel Esquire. I saw it, and I can see it now, because that is not a Denzel performance. That is not what he's done over
mm-hmm.
the course of his career. It's very hooded and interior.
Yeah.
It's marked by a kind of self-lacerating self-hate in a way
mm-hmm.
that, and you can feel the core of this character kind of rotting away in a purely, you can feel the core of this character kind of rotting away, and it's a really strong performance in a movie that is very heavy-handed and
yeah.
weird. And
didn't care for the film.
No.
But I understand what people were getting at about the performance.
But you can see when that scene happens and he's putting himself out there and he chokes back tears and you're like, oh. There it is.
Yeah. No.
Well,
boom, done.
And it's an actor. It's a very well-known actor getting by without some of the habits that
exactly.
he often leans on.
Yeah.
The one of the ones that does frustrate me is I think Gary Oldman is going to win for Darkest Hour.
Mm.
And I think that Daniel Kaluuya performance in Get Out is so mm-hmm. much more complicated than it initially seems, because the whole thing throughout most of the movie is him trying to maintain his cool and normalcy
yep.
in increasingly not normal circumstances. And I think it's easy for that reason not to appreciate the complexity of what he's doing. That's a hard one for me to swallow, is the idea that he's likely gonna not get that award
yeah.
and it's gonna go to a much more traditional, historical that kind of thing.
Very Oscars-y performance. I mean, I'm going to feel that way about several of these nominated performances. I mean, I think Timothée Chalamet in Call Me By Your Name is such an incredibly nuanced performance. We've talked about it a number of times. I think I agree with you, Glenn, that Denzel Washington's performance in Roman J. Israel is superb. It is one of those movies, and there are several of those movies every Oscar season, where the film just feels... It's a performance, and the performance is the skeleton that they just kind of try to hang a movie on.
Yeah.
As much as that movie didn't really do it for me, that performance is very, very nuanced and pretty special. And I'm glad that it was acknowledged. But yeah, Kaluuya would be great. I mean, I just look at these nominees, and Gary Oldman to me. We talked about it at great length when we talked about Darkest Hour. I just didn't think that performance was quite as.
I was astonished it got nominated.
I was astonished. I mean, it's gonna win.
I know. I would have told you after seeing that film. I saw it in Toronto at the film festival, and it was a snooze.
Yeah, the take out of Toronto was that it was pretty forgettable.
It is pretty forgettable.
Yeah,
I've seen it again since. It's really
forgettable.
Because you forgot that you'd seen it.
And my frustration with it is that he's giving a big, showy, dumb performance, and I don't understand why that connects with people in Hollywood who ought to know better, except that he's done great performances in the past.
Yeah.
There's an argument for giving somebody an award later who is unlikely ever to get another role that's going to put him in a position to win an award. But as a practical matter, Timothée Chalamet walks all over him.
Yeah.
And in all the betting sites, it's Chalamet is second to Gary Oldman. So if Gary Oldman was going to lose, he'd probably lose to Chalamet.
Gary Oldman breaks his leg. All right, we need to take a quick break. We're going to come back. We have a few other categories that we're going to talk about, including some that we took on to try to make sure that we hit some of the categories that we don't always get a chance to talk about. So come right back.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from The Good Fight on CBS All Access. In Season 2, the staff of the law firm find themselves under psychological assault when a client at another firm kills his lawyer for overcharging. If you haven't seen Season 1 of The Good Fight, catch up on this critically acclaimed show now and then get geared up for Season 2, premiering March 4th exclusively on CBS All Access. Visit cbs.com/happyhour to find out more and get a free trial.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. We're in the middle of our Oscars show, and one thing that we have not talked about yet is directing. Now, the directors who were nominated this year, you have Jordan Peele for Get Out, you have Paul Thomas Anderson for Phantom Thread, you have Christopher Nolan for Dunkirk, Greta Gerwig for Lady Bird, and Guillermo del Toro for The Shape of Water. Now, I would pick Jordan Peele, but I don't know a lot about directing. I would also be perfectly thrilled with Greta Gerwig because I think that's also a really hard film to make well. But we think it's going to be Del Toro, right?
Yeah.
I'm almost certain. Yeah. I mean, there's such a pattern throughout Oscar history of, you know, The Life of Pi. Remember when Ang Lee won for Life of Pi? It's in part because it was a beautiful story well told, but it's also so visually stunning.
Yeah.
Same with Gravity, when Gravity won Best Director but not Best Picture.
Yeah.
In keeping with my Three Billboards prediction, I mean, Martin McDonagh is not nominated for Best Director, which I agree with completely.
Mm.
I think you're very likely to see a split where Del Toro walks away with Best Director, but Best Picture goes to something like Three Billboards.
That's probably true, but I would really love to see Christopher Nolan recognized. I mean, the guy has never been nominated as director before.
And that's amazing.
Which is crazy. And this picture has three interlocked storylines and almost no dialogue.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, what is weird is that for more than 2 hours, all of it's clear.
Yeah.
Right, and I just think that by itself, that is a director's movie in a way that none of the rest of them are.
Right, right. I mean, it's not fair to kind of judge on degree of difficulty, logistics, but kind of.
Yeah, I mean, it's a thing.
Between that and, you know, the fact that a lot of Shape of Water took place underwater, my heart goes to Nolan on this particular one.
Interesting.
I don't think it's going to happen.
Interesting.
Yeah, I don't either.
Well, so one thing that we did for this show that we haven't always done is that Stephen and Glenn and I each took a category that we were going to jump into and see all the films and talk a little bit about that category. Stephen, what was your category?
My category was animated feature.
Okay.
Or Coco and four other movies. And, you know, my kids are a little older now, so I haven't seen as many animated movies in a year as I used to.
Now you got
to
watch them by yourself.
So I had to sit down by myself. Actually, my 17-year-old son sat down next to me. We popped a bunch of popcorn and watched The Boss Baby.
Nice.
Yes.
And that's because somehow my 17-year-old son still loves me.
Yeah.
Sure, but so the nominees are, in addition to Coco, which I think we can agree that's going to win in a walk. That's probably the biggest slam dunk
likely
of the night.
Likely to win.
But the other four films were a very interesting cross-section of the kind of movies that can get nominated for animated feature. And when you think about that category, animated can mean a lot of things. So you have The Breadwinner, which is this very grim and sad, but faintly hopeful story of a family under the thumb of the Taliban. You have Loving Vincent, which is the story of Vincent Van Gogh.
Told in oil paintings,
in thousands and thousands and thousands of oil paintings. So there you have this incredible technical feat. Mm-hmm. The story is fairly humdrum. But those are two movies on kind of the artier and more serious side of the spectrum. And then on the other side, in addition to The Boss Baby, which I mentioned, is Ferdinand. And what's interesting about those movies, I think a lot of people saw this category and thought, The Boss Baby. You know, we've been joking about it, behind the scenes, like Academy Award nominee, The Boss Baby.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The Boss Baby is a weirdly inventive movie, kind of for little kids. When I watched it on Netflix, and at the bottom of the screen, in the title card, it said kids 5 to 7.
That's my age group.
Mm. And mine too. Certainly my emotional age group. But first of all, you think, like, this is a movie for little kids, but they also do a number of kind of inventive things. It's a very odd story, and in a way, it's kind of a big swing. They are very committed to their idea of that some babies are corporate. and it ultimately, it sort of resolves itself in all the expected ways. But along the way, there are patches of really beautiful animation where they kind of animate different scenes in different styles. That movie, as much as it is obviously a very, very big kind of mainstream animated movie, I did not sit there with my arms folded during it at all. Okay. The biggest surprise for me in these nominees actually is Ferdinand, which you don't necessarily see where The Boss Baby is going. You know it's going to resolve itself in a certain way, but you're not sure how it's going
to... Gunfight.
Gunfight. You're not exactly sure how it's going to get there. In Ferdinand, there is not one single solitary second of that movie that will surprise you.
Yeah.
It is a very, very charming voice cast. John Cena should play animated bulls as much as you want. He's delightful. You have Megan Mullally and just a lot of people whose voices you just love to hear pop up. And that kind of keeps that. Oh, Flew LeBorg does a voice in that movie, Glenn.
of YouTube.
Of YouTube. That movie to me was surprising just because there was nothing about it that was surprising. It was so middle of the road. And you had a movie like the Lego Batman movie.
I was going to say.
Which is so packed with jokes.
Jokes.
And so funny and silly and just enormously engaging. If you remember, the Lego movie was also not nominated for animated feature. Mm-hmm. And to me, I start to wonder if the inexpensiveness of that particular animation doesn't work against it in award season, where people in the animation world that are voting on these movies are not pleased to see them bypassing so many jobs. That's my only theory, because I think those movies are tremendous and delightful. And the Lego Batman movie, greater than Ferdinand, which is just so average.
You don't think it's a conspiracy by Big Lincoln Logs? All right. I have been told that I was too mean to Boss Baby because I've never seen it. So I was absolutely just reacting to the idea of it. I will watch it. Glenn, what was your category?
Foreign language films. And so, you think things are kind of bleak here in the States. Oh, boy. Oh, man. The rest of the world feels even worse than we do based on these five films. First one is The Insult. It's from Lebanon. It's about a Lebanese Christian and a Palestinian refugee. They have a dispute over plumbing that becomes physical, and then it becomes legal, and then it becomes cultural. And, of course, the reason for that conflict, it's motivated by their deep mutual mistrust and animosity. I've read reviews saying, and this conflict just mushrooms. It doesn't. The thing that makes this good is that it ratchets up inevitably in this kind of a way that fills you with dread. And again, these two Combatants are given off-ramps to take. They could de-escalate at any minute, and they don't, and they're just locked in. And they do get swept up by their legal teams. They get swept up by the cultures to go against each other. The ending, I think, is a little less than satisfying. It feels a little pat in this film that you think is building to this harrowing something. Doesn't quite get there, so I'm not sure. But that's the insult from Lebanon. Anything you want to say about it, Bob?
I liked it and wasn't overwhelmed.
Okay. Next, The Square from Sweden. It's a satire of the art community that targets the hypocrisy and brutality and cowardice of humanity because Sweden. And what it's making fun of is how we have all these dark impulses and we couch them in kind of loftier, very self-congratulatory, this bubble of aesthetic appreciation where we can kind of feel like we can be better than we are in a really interesting way. It's funny. So I liked it. It's weirdly structured. It's a series of vignettes.
And it has Elizabeth Moss.
It's got Elizabeth Moss in there.
And one of the big vignettes, which you can find on YouTube so that you don't have to watch the whole movie to see it, is the sequence where there's an actor who's done a lot of
ape work.
And he comes into a room filled with people who are actually in the Swedish world of the arts. And proceeds to mate with one of the people there and all kinds of... it is an astonishing sequence.
Yeah.
12 minutes long and unnerving in ways that very few things have been this year in films.
Yeah, so sign up for that. I mean, yeah.
That's the only one that I can honestly tell you I saw.
Uh-huh.
I didn't get it.
Yeah.
That's not true.
I got it. It's kind of hard not to get it.
I got it.
All right, next is On Body and Soul from Hungary. Bob and I disagree on this film. Two factory workers in a slaughterhouse, and you will not forget that they work in a slaughterhouse because it's eager to show you slaughtering.
Everything that happens in slaughterhouses.
Lots of slaughtering. They fall in love when they start having the same dreams. And the dreams are gorgeous. He's a buck, she's a doe in this snowy field, forest with a lake. Very just amazing to look at. And the slaughterhouse is very slaughtery. So you have these two worlds that I think my issue with is that it has this airy absurdism even in the slaughterhouse scenes that doesn't feel like it contrasts. It's like if you have seen any early Jane Campion, it has these ideas, this tone, this feeling of absurdism, which you would call whimsical and fabulous if it wasn't so brutally misanthropic. Hates people and does not trust us.
No.
See, they disagree about this.
That's not what that film's about at all.
And then on a plot level, Bob.
Yeah.
Again, it's absurdism. It's kind of like when I was talking about Shape of Water, and it's like, well, whatever. It's a fable. There's a crime that happens. The crime doesn't make any sense. The reaction to the crime doesn't make any sense. And the resolution to the crime doesn't make any sense. And we're supposed to go like, oh, yeah. Well,
Art.
Go nuts, Bob. Why do you thought it was moving?
Well, yeah. I mean, the first hour of it, I will concede that I was reacting to it very much as you were. As it goes on, it becomes more and more about the two central characters who are having those dreams. And her situation both of their situations become much more engaging and involving and started to distress me. And then there is an incident in her life, which I will not specify, that tells me why there was all that blood in the first half.
Mm-hmm.
I ultimately found the picture really moving. I turned to my husband at the end of it and said, that was really good.
Hmm. More power to you, because I was engaged in the first half, not the second half. Okay, next, Loveless from Russia with the lack of love. Boy, hoo boy.
I think you mean film directors from Russia.
Oh, boy. A couple who is in the middle of a divorce, their son, their 11-year-old son, vanishes. And the state can't help them. The volunteers teach them how to work the system. Something is very wrong with the system. That's what you're supposed to kind of get from this movie. This film, like, you know, you guys talked about Annihilation and how it felt like you were kind of drugged when mm-hmm. it came out of it. This film feels like untreated depression. It is long. It is bleak. It is punishing to watch. Take it away, Bob.
By which you mean effective?
That's what I mean. I mean,
because
it's
that's exactly what it's trying to be.
Yeah.
I mean, yes, you're right, and it doesn't give you the rooting interest that you had in something like Leviathan, which is the director's previous film, which was all about a land grab, and mm-hmm. you could hate the authorities, and there were all these people. And in this one, you don't have that, because I think he's making a movie that is basically about Russian society and how empty it feels in the Putin years, mm-hmm. which has gotten everybody in Russia, apparently, to hate this picture.
Yeah.
I think he's been effective about doing exactly what he wanted to do, and you're right. It is not something that most people want to go to the movies for.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I got it at an hour 45. By 2 hours and 30 minutes, I was really getting
wow.
it.
Wow. I got to say, people thought I had a tough draw.
Let's talk about something better. A fantastic woman from Chile. A trans woman who falls in love with this divorced dude. He dies. She must deal with, on a daily basis, his family, the police, her coworkers. They put her through different kinds of hell. Microaggressions and some pretty macro, really macro aggressions. And what it does is it puts us in this woman's head without and kind of stepping back and saying, see, this is what life is like. It feels intimate. Also, it helps that there's a dance number. I mean, I'm not going to say it doesn't not help. It helps that there's a dance number. So she arrives at a kind of triumph, which doesn't feel small, doesn't feel pyrrhic. It feels like a resolution that is satisfying in a way that a lot of the other films just didn't for me.
Mm. I think that's fair.
All right. My category was technically adapted screenplay. I looked at both of the screenplay categories. The only original screenplay nominated that we haven't already talked about is The Big Sick.
Heard of it.
We'll get to that when we talk about movies we wish had been nominated.
In the adapted screenplay category, Call Me By Your Name is nominated and Mudbound, which we've already talked about, is nominated. I think they both have exceptional stories and storytelling. The Disaster Artist, we did a show about. My thoughts about The Disaster Artist are in that show and you know, have not changed that much. The ones that it really gave me a chance to look at more closely than I had previously were Molly's Game, which I saw all the way back in Toronto, and then Logan. And I'll get to Logan in a second. Molly's Game is the first directorial effort by Aaron Sorkin. It's also, he wrote the screenplay, obviously. It's about a woman who runs a poker game based on a real woman, but, you know, somewhat, I think, liberally adapted from her book. And I think, you know, this movie emphasizes to me that my entire career is building toward my inevitable onstage discussion with Aaron Sorkin. because Aaron Sorkin is the heart and soul of my love of dialogue. Mm-hmm. I have listened to so much Aaron Sorkin dialogue, and I love it so much. It is almost impossible for me to write dialogue and not be sometimes doing Aaron Sorkin because mm-hmm. I love it so much and because it's so musical to me in a way that I don't think is matched by anybody in American culture for me except Cole Porter. But his stories, and particularly the way that he writes women, drives me absolutely berserk. And that continues to be the case in this film. So I am stuck with this screenplay on the horns of this dilemma where he writes so beautifully, and yet I don't like the direction in which he takes stories and scenes, including some of the things that appear to be liberties taken from the book that were invented by him that go back to all this stuff about the way he writes women. So I have extremely mixed feelings about that one. Also some mixed feelings about Logan. Now, Logan is another Wolverine movie mm-hmm. In the X-Men world. If you like superhero movies but want to feel terrible, this is the film for you. This is the bleakest, darkest, grimmest, most violent superhero movie you can probably imagine. I think Hugh Jackman is good in it. I think Patrick Stewart is good in it. I understand why people felt that this film was well done, but I would rather eat a bowl of bees than ever watch this movie ever again. It is so bloody. It is like you need to see people not just stabbed with claws over and over and over again and claws coming out of people's heads and just, but there's a point where they slow it down so that the person is more like watching it happen to themselves. And it's so slow and sadistic in this way that ultimately made me really uncomfortable. But on a screenplay level, on a screenplay level, I think the storytelling and the way the script is done work. So I have mixed feelings about both mm-hmm. of these. I would probably choose Call Me By Your Name, but that's because I liked the movie the most, mm-hmm. and I'm not sure that I can tease those out that well. I do want to get to a couple of other things before we run out of time. We have to move very quickly. But Glenn, you wanted to mention a category or two that you think is shaping up to be interesting to watch.
Yeah, in a in a season where lots of things are locks, it seems like cinematography. So cinematography, you've got Blade Runner 2049 by Roger Deakins, who has been nominated 14 times, never won, and Mudbound by Rachel Morrison, the first woman cinematographer nominated. So you've got The Moment versus The Establishment, so that'll be interesting to watch. The other one is costuming. Every year I get this wrong because I always think it's got to be the more fantastic costumes, the ones for space opera or for fantasy, and it never ever is. The people who win are bustles and tulle and organza and crepe, old ladies in dresses. So, but this year it's really interesting because you got Beauty and the Beast, which is all that plus some kind of fantasy stuff. You've got Phantom Thread, which is about making costumes and dresses. And you've got Victorian Abdul. I think it's going to be Victorian Abdul. Bustles and tulle and organza and crepe. That's my bet.
And not Darkest Hour.
Not Darkest Hour.
Stephen, before we go, you wanted to run off a list of some of the stuff that you wished was nominated.
Yeah.
That wasn't nominated.
Yeah, I mean,
Give it to me.
Yeah, we were gonna talk at some point in the show about snubs. And so I just compiled a list I will call Stephen's Grievances.
Stephen's Grievances.
We have barely mentioned The Big Sick, in part because its filmmakers are friendly acquaintances of the show. We would be having a different conversation about my rooting interests if The Big Sick had been nominated for Best Picture. It always drives me nuts when they nominate fewer than 10, because the snub isn't this got in and this didn't, but this didn't get in, instead nothing got in.
Right.
Also, two of its performances, not only Holly Hunter in the supporting actress category, I really felt she was left out unfairly, and I was disappointed that Ray Romano, who is terrific in that movie, is so much better dramatic actor than you think he is, and he's funny. Supporting actor is a category where I would have turned over almost the entire lineup. I look at not only Ray Romano, who I mentioned, Lil Rel Howery in Get Out. People talk about Tiffany Haddish in Girls Trip, and that's another person I would have been,
delighted
to see nominated. Mm-hmm. But Lil Rel Howery in Get Out provides so much of the humor and so much of the joy and is such an audience surrogate in that movie in a wonderful, wonderful way. I felt like that was a star-making performance that I would have loved to have seen awarded. Michael Stuhlbarg in Call Me By Your Name gives the tear-jerkingest speech of the year. I mean, it's just an Oscar clip, but he's wonderful in it, and he happens to be in three of the Best Picture nominees. Mm-hmm. He's also in The Post and also in The Shape of Water. I think that's a lovely performance, and I will always be a stan for Tracy Letts, who's the dad in Lady Bird. I think that performance is so moving and so kind and so lovely, and man, I could just go through this list, but I will stop.
Oh, Thompson, I always like to hear your grievances. Well, and we also want to know what you are thinking about the Oscars. Come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet at us at PCHH. When we come back, it's going to be time for our favorite segment of this week and every week, What is Making Us Happy This Week? So come right back.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from MasterClass, producing online classes taught by masters of their craft. Each class is shot with cinematic production quality and offers on-demand lessons loaded with exclusive content. Classes include Gordon Ramsay teaches cooking, Annie Leibovitz teaches photography, Steph Curry teaches basketball, and more. Pop Culture Happy Hour listeners can unlock every class with the new All Access Pass. Available now at masterclass.com/happyhour.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Please help us out by telling us what you like and how we could improve by completing a short anonymous survey at npr.org/podcastsurvey. It takes just a few minutes, and you'll do all of us at Pop Culture Happy Hour a huge favor by filling it out. That's npr.org/podcastsurvey. Thank you.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It's time for our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week, my friend?
As inevitable as Coco's victory for Best Animated Feature is that it is time for me to talk about the Austin 100.
Yep. It is.
Every year before South by Southwest, I put together a 100-song, entirely downloadable playlist of discoveries from the South by Southwest Music Festival. I listen to roughly 1,500 songs, pick my 100 favorites, then I write about them, and I clear them for download. I do this whole
Stephen's giving me the workflow.
Weeks and weeks and weeks of toil go into this project. It is finally, as of this taping, it is live and out in the world. There's an enormous amount of terrific music, all of which you can download with the click of a Do people still use a mouse? Yeah. The click of a mouse pad. You can have 100 free MP3s. Obviously, you can also stream it for those of you who like that sort of thing. It is a gigantic labor of love and also a labor of labor every year. And I plead with every single person listening to this to go download it, check it out. It's npr.org/Austin100. I can practically guarantee you that you will find something you love that you have never heard before.
Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
The fourth season of the Canadian CBC series Schitt's Creek, S-C-H-I-T-T apostrophe S, has just dropped on Pop, which is a network, apparently.
Yeah, it is.
So Eugene Levy, Catherine O'Hara, Annie Murphy, Chris Elliott, Jennifer Robertson as the secret weapon of that show is Jocelyn, Emily Hampshire, Noah Reed, Dan Levy. So this is a sitcom, right? And it's got a beating sitcom heart with beating sitcom situations where, like, for example, Eugene Levy discovers a pregnancy test in his daughter's room. So he has a conversation with her that he thinks is about her having a baby. She thinks it's about her going to college. Wackiness ensues, right? But around that is something much smarter, nuanced, quieter. And what happens is, and every sitcom has the characters who don't know how ridiculous they are and the people they're kind of bouncing off again, the normal people, which again is one of the things that Jennifer Robertson is great at, bouncing off of Catherine O'Hara's Maura. The great thing that can happen as you go into a series and it develops, in this case, I think the show is getting better. Dan Levy is allowing his character to go from being somebody who has no idea how ridiculous he is to somebody who can kind of start to hear himself. And that's happening because he's in a relationship with this guy, Patrick, played by Noah Reed. He's coming out and he doesn't know what's happening. And Dan Levy's character has a lot more experience. And yet, he can hear himself as he bounces off against this guy. And what's happening is this potentially broad show is becoming human, smarter. Dan Levy, whose face never stops moving, is just a great comic actor who is bringing something deeper, something that you couldn't have seen in the first season. So that's Schitt's Creek, fourth season. It's great.
Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Bob Mondello, what is making you happy this week?
No one is more surprised by the fact that I am now reading than I am. I don't read. I have never read. I don't do it. Anyway, I'm
there's
reading.
Hope for me yet.
I know, you're biting Thompson style.
I have found, once again, Alan Bennett, who I just love his writing. He's the guy who wrote History Boys and Madness of King George and Lady in the Van. And 50 years ago, when he turned 40, he wrote a book that was basically a memoir called Getting On, which is an astonishing thing to think at age 40. He has now written a memoir called Keeping On, Keeping On. Uh-huh. And it is so funny. Every night I'm reading another chapter or two of this thing. It's mostly a memoir. The first half of it is all memoir. And all of his observations about everything from rehearsals for History Boys to meeting someone in a church while he's wandering around looking at medieval paintings is hilarious. He's a wonderful writer. I laugh every time I'm reading him. It's Keeping On, Keeping On, and it's really just a lovely read.
Thank you so much, Bob Mondello. What is making me happy this week? We just have recently seen the end of the Winter Olympics, and the Olympics certainly offer many opportunities for stories that are not actually that interesting, in my opinion. However, now and then, you get one that thrills you from the bottoms of your feet to the tops, to the top of your head. And mine this year was the U.S. curling team, men's curling team, which won the gold medal at the Winter Olympics. Now, there was a time when you could legitimately say you were an oddball for watching a lot of curling during the Olympics. But now everyone does it. Yeah. Everyone gets into curling during the time of the Winter Olympics. However, what many people don't know is that there's a long saga of the men's curling team, and it's Skip, whose name is John Schuster. And John Schuster is a largely ordinary dude who still works at a sporting goods store when he is not going to the Olympics as the skip of the U.S. curling team. Now, he went to the Olympics in 2010, sort of choked. Went in 2014, sort of choked. They actually they pulled him out, and he basically had to force his way back in. His team had to sort of force its way back in to be the Olympic team. He has been obliterated on Twitter for 8 years, despite being a good curler, and everyone on Twitter who is eviscerating him knows nothing about curling. Yeah. Guy just kept coming back, and this year he won a gold medal. And my hope is that a million Twitter avatars exploded in
shame. So spite is what's making it happen.
Oh, not just spite, but the best kind of spite, which is somebody kept going through horrible social media abuse from people who don't know what they're talking about, which is my favorite thing. Persevered, won a gold medal. John Schuster, you are my personal Wheaties box.
Yep. Vindication plus spite.
Vindication plus spite. John Schuster. Also, the women's hockey team.
Yeah.
I mean, lots of team stuff to be very, very happy about. None more than the curling Skip and his fellas winning the gold medal. And that is what is making me happy this week. That brings us to the end of our show. You can find all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen. You can follow Glenn at GH Weldon. And you can follow Bob at Bob _ Mondello. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica _ Reedy. And our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff. That's KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides the music that you are bobbing your head to right now. So thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
And thanks to all of you for listening. And we will see you right back here on Monday for our Oscars wrap. And then we will be back with regular content later next week.